I think the problem is that because alcohol is a drug, it's all about tolerance. You know, like any other drug, you know, when you first start taking it, it has a huge effect. And then over time, it has less and less effect. So you increase the amount that you take in order to have the effect that it had before. So, and we don't, because we don't think of alcohol as a drug, we don't, we forget that that's the mechanism, you know, that exists. So what starts happening is, you know, your one glass of wine that you used to have at the end of the day to de-stress, you know, starts not working in the way it used to. So you have two, and then you have three. So, you know, so that 14 unit maximum might have been absolutely fine to give you exactly what you wanted from alcohol, you know, back a few years back, but you'll find that it won't stay like that because that's not the way drugs work.
Hello and welcome to the Building Better Leaders podcast, brought to you by Scaffold Coaching. I'm Rachel Sullivan.
And I'm John Tattersall.
Hello and welcome to episode 41 of the Building Better Leaders podcast. Today we are joined by author Claire Pooley. Claire's book, The Sober Diaries, a memoir of her journey for the first year of giving up the booze, is a book that has had a profound impact on my life. I've read it not once, not twice, but three times during various Stoptobers, dry Januaries, and deciding to give up alcohol for 3 months earlier this year. I am what Claire would probably describe as being sober curious. Since having my son, I've been wanting to reevaluate the relationship that I have with alcohol, predominantly to just be curious and open to what my potential could be and who I actually am without the booze. I was absolutely ecstatic when Claire agreed to be a guest on the podcast. To say I'm a fan is a huge understatement. I feel very proud and very privileged and very humbled that she agreed to come on the podcast. It's like meeting one of my heroes virtually. But I really hope that you all get a lot out of this podcast. It's by no means a message of, you know, to be a better leader, you need to give up the booze. It's not about that at all. It's rather acknowledging the fact that a lot of us have slid into a relationship with booze and alcohol that possibly is limiting our potential as a leader. I got a bit excited and giddy at a few bits in the podcast, so I've put some outtakes at the very end if you are keen to listen to those. But for now, over to the conversation. Claire, John and I are delighted to have you on the podcast. Welcome. Would you like to introduce yourselves to our listeners, please?
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for having me on the show.
So for people that haven't heard of you and that haven't read your book, The Sober Diaries, do you want to just give a quick introduction to yourself, tell us about you, and then just go straight into your story?
Okay. So my name is Claire Pooley. I am an author of fiction initially, a non-fiction initially, The Sober Diaries, and now fiction. So I've just published my first novel, which is called The Authenticity Project. But before that, I was in advertising. I was in advertising for nearly 20 years, and I worked in one of the biggest global agencies of the time, J. Walter Thompson, and worked on all sorts of really sort of major brands like Kit Kat and Rolo and Shell and Unilever and, you know, you name it. So that's my background.
And so we've asked you to come onto the podcast today to talk about the subject of leadership and alcohol. It's by no means us preaching around people shouldn't drink, things like that, but rather we'd just like to think about the awareness of how much people are drinking and just get into a bit of discussion around what impact consuming alcohol quite regularly over a long period of time may have on your leadership style. So do you want to take us back to you being a leader at JWT and how did your relationship with alcohol progress? What did it look like back in the day and how did it get to a stage where it was a problem and what did that look like and what were the impacts?
Okay. You know what? I think the embarrassing thing is, I'm going to confess this right now. I think part of the reason I went into advertising was because I loved having a drink, going out, having fun. And I thought it was a sort of industry that encouraged that sort of behavior. So I think I partly chose advertising because I was a big drinker rather than advertising making me a big drinker. So, you know, or maybe it was a bit of both. But anyhow, I joined advertising in the early 90s. And if you've watched Mad Men, which was set in the 1960s and 1970s, it was still very much like that in the 90s. So, you know, we all smoked, we all drank. We had not one bar in the office, but two bars in the office, one for directors and one for normal people. And I had a huge expense budget. And part of my job was going out and getting clients drunk at various, you know, top restaurants and clubs and what have you. And it was a real work hard, sort of play hard culture. And I absolutely loved it. And I threw myself into it. And also back then, it was the era of Bridget Jones and Absolutely Fabulous and Sex and the City. And, you know, I sort of thought it was my feminist duty to keep up with the men and to drink as much as they did. And, you know, it was the era of the ladette. You know, that's what we did. It was sort of, it was our way of showing that we were feisty and independent and nothing like our mother's generation. So, you know, it was a great fun time. But what started happening is over time, I started using alcohol for more and more different reasons. So I started off using it as a way to have fun. You know, it was like social lubrication, and it ended up being self-medication, really, in that, you know, I started using it to deal with stress, and then I get more stressed, and then I drink more. And, you know, I started using it as a way of getting to sleep when I was, you know, I felt I couldn't sleep properly. I basically used alcohol for pretty much any occasion. You know, I used it to celebrate, I used it to commiserate, I used it to rev up, I used it to wind down, you know, I used it when I was happy, I used it when I was sad. And so you can see that by this point, you know, I was drinking way too much. And by the time I got to my mid-40s, my tolerance level had increased so much that I could drink a bottle of wine without really showing any effect. So people never knew that I had a problem as such, because, you know, they rarely saw me looking drunk, you know, but I could drink an awful lot without looking drunk. But when you're drinking as much as that, and this was, you know, I was drinking a bottle of wine a day and about two bottles of wine a day at weekends. So 10 bottles a week, which is 90 units. And, you know, if you think the government guidelines of 14 units, you know, that's way more than is healthy. So it was having a huge impact on my mental health and my physical health. So just to give you an example, I was a terrible insomnia. I had really bad anxiety. I had very little energy. I was also a mum with three kids, and I felt like I wasn't being a good mother. And I felt like my whole life had really become stuck in a bit of a rut that I couldn't climb my way out of. And eventually, you know, after much agonizing, I realized that the reason for all of that was the amount I was drinking.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing that. And I think what you talked about then is something that we see a lot in the workplace. I think that alcohol's first your friend. It gives you that confidence boost, and then you start to use it to wind down and de-stress, and then it starts to just become something you're consuming a little bit too much. And before we talk about it in relation to leadership, the premise of your book is your journey from giving up alcohol, and it's a day-by-day account of what happens to you. Just talk us through, you know, you were at a stage where you were drinking a bottle of wine a day, which I know sounds extreme, and there'll be some people listening to this and thinking, goodness me, I'm nowhere near that. But 14 units a week is not much. That's, you know, it's not two bottles of wine a week. So I guess there's a lot of us that are probably in perhaps not 90 units a week, but way over that recommended amount. You know, if it's three bottles of wine a week or something, what was your experience on that first kind of 3 months of giving up? What were the biggest things you started to notice and the benefits?
Oh, well, you know, part of the reason I wrote the book is because when I was looking at giving up, I felt really ashamed and really alone. And I really wanted, I didn't want anyone else to feel like that. And I wanted to give people an idea of what to expect, because everything I read was all about, you know, people's drinking stories. It was sort of, you know, and I was familiar with all of that. And then I get to the end of this memoir about somebody's, you know, somebody's drinking issues. And at the end they say, and then I gave up and everything was fine. And I thought, well, what happens next? You know, what happens when you give up? And the reality is that, you know, things don't change overnight. You know, if you've ever done a dry January, for instance, you'll find that actually, that, you know, it doesn't make as much difference as you might think it would. It's really hard, but you don't see major benefits. And actually, the truth is, it takes about 100 days before the real benefits start kicking in. And, you know, so initially, what you find is when you first quit, if you've been drinking quite a lot, you will, you know, it is hard. You'll find you're utterly exhausted. You become more obsessed by the idea of alcohol than you were when you're drinking, because you have this little voice constantly in your head sort of, you know, telling you that that having a drink would be a really good idea, honest. So you become quite obsessive about it. You know, you might have some physical symptoms, like initially not being able to sleep very well, having bad headaches, you know, and initially it's really hard, and you know, you have to battle with cravings quite frequently. And then, you know, but by the time you get to 100 days, miraculous things start to happen. I mean, really, really miraculous. You know, you start to sleep like a baby. You probably lose a lot of weight, because there are endless calories in alcohol. So unless you're replacing it with cake, which actually a lot of people do, then you'll probably lose weight. You have a lot more energy. You find that mornings are completely transformed. You know, I was never a morning person in the old days, and now I bounce out of bed at 5 a.m., you know, sort of with loads of energy, which is extraordinary. And, you know, I found also, as a lot of people do, that not drinking really fired up my creativity. So, you know, all that, you know, we think about, you know, tortured artists sort of sitting with their bottle of whiskey. But the reality is that alcohol dampens down your creativity, and not drinking is a great way of sort of revitalizing it. So yes, after about 100 days, you do see miraculous things.
Claire, I'm really curious around the numbers that the government guidelines say. And I wonder, are they in some respect a little bit counterproductive, because they are so low for many people in terms of what perhaps other people drink, that they think that they can't possibly get down to that level? And therefore, as you were explaining, you know, you could drink a bottle of wine and actually not feel that much effect from it. And so they think, well, actually, the government guidelines are wrong.
Well, that's certainly the way that I used to think. So, I think you may well be right in that, you know, as far as I was concerned, nobody stuck to the government guidelines, you know. So, and if you're a big drinker, you tend to surround yourself by other big drinkers. So, you know, I'd look at all my friends and my colleagues and I thought, well, nobody is sticking to 14 units a week. So, you know, it doesn't really count. And once you've gone way over the government guidelines, you might as well go for it. It was sort of my attitude. But I think the issue is, the reason they have to set them so low is that there are a huge number of studies, which again, I paid no attention to whatsoever, that show that there is a massive link between alcohol and things like cancer. So alcohol is linked to at least 7 different types of cancer, breast cancer being one of the major ones. And they reckon that any amount of alcohol actually increases your cancer risk, but it increases significantly more after about 14 units. So they set it that low because there are so many studies that show that any more than that really is, you know, bad for your physical health as well as your mental health. So yes, but I think you're right. I think it does feel unachievable.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think on that, John, as well, it's a great observation, but being somebody that's done a lot of dry Januaries and Stocktobers and 3 months off and a 9 months off when I was pregnant, etc. So in the last 3 years, I've had
lots of periods of not drinking for a long time, and then I've had periods of binge drinking. I think that 14 units, if you didn't drink, so if you're a younger person today, it makes total sense, because just having a couple of glasses of wine, you can fit within that. And I think when I've had periods of doing a dry January or a sober October, when you have done that and you get to it and you have your first two glasses of wine, you realize how poisonous it is, because you feel bloody dreadful. I mean, like, seriously dreadful. So 14 units sounds, of course, okay. I think the issue is when you're up in the 40s and 50s, bringing it down to that level, when your body is so used to, I mean, I can drink a bottle of wine and not, so can you, John, not feel any effects from it. And I think that's where the difference looks. But I think that that number probably works better for young people a lot more. How you balance that to bring people down from such high numbers, I'm not sure.
I think the problem is that because alcohol is a drug, it's all about tolerance, you know, like any other drug. You know, when you first start taking it, it has a huge effect. And then over time, it has less and less effect. So you increase the amount that you take in order to have the effect that it had before. So, and because we don't think of alcohol as a drug, we forget that that's the mechanism, you know, that exists. So what starts happening is, you know, your one glass of wine that you used to have at the end of the day to de-stress, you know, starts not working in the way it used to. So you have two, and then you have three. So, you know, so that 14 unit maximum might have been absolutely fine to give you exactly what you wanted from alcohol, you know, back a few years back, but you'll find that it won't stay like that, because that's not the way drugs work.
Yes, yeah. And it can also be used, I think, from lots of us as a almost like a badge of honor, that you can drink that amount and actually still feel okay. So is it really doing me any harm? I mean, those 14 units, that's so low, I think I'm going to be okay. And I think in the same way that it takes a long time to get out of your system, you're talking about 100 days to really notice any difference. It's probably, is it not the same the other way around, that actually it just takes so much longer for you to start feeling bad if you have a high number of units?
Yeah, and you get used to it, you know. I mean, I never felt like I had really bad hangovers, but I was always under par in the morning. I just didn't realize it, because I was used to feeling like that. So it wasn't until I'd quit for some time that I realized that I felt completely different in the mornings, you know, than I used to. So all of these things happen really gradually. I mean, the increase in tolerance, you know, I started drinking in my teens and I quit in my mid-40s. And so my tolerance had, you know, 30 years to build up to that level. So it's a very slow process and you don't really notice it. And I think, you know, I think what we were talking about this morning is, you know, is how to be more mindful of that. So, you know, it's not necessarily about quitting altogether. It's just about being mindful of what's going on and how to manage it.
What happened to you then, Claire, in terms of your self-awareness? What was it, a long period of time, or was it one particular incident, or how did you become more self-aware that this is something that you couldn't continue to do?
I think it took me a long time, because I didn't want to quit altogether. You know, I enjoyed drinking too much. It was, and I also sort of thought it was part of my self-image, to be honest. You know, it was, yeah. And all, you know, it was what all my friends were doing. It was, you know, I didn't want to be that person that doesn't drink. So I tried for years to drink more sensibly, and you know, and I just couldn't do it. So, you know, and I think generally people fall into two camps. You're either somebody who is good at moderating or you're all or nothing. And I'm very much an all or nothing person. And I wish I wasn't in many ways, although there are advantages, you know, in that I'm all or nothing about everything, which can be a good thing. As a result, you know, whenever I tried to cut down, I would set myself rules and try and stick to them. And I'd do it for a bit and then I'd fall off the wagon again and sort of, you know, all the rules would go to hell. And I'd be right back where I started. And it just started taking up way too much head space. So I spent so much time thinking about whether I was going to drink, how much I was going to drink, what I was going to drink, where I was going to buy it, all that sort of stuff, round and round and round. And it just started driving me crazy. And it didn't give me any space for anything else. And that's the point at which I thought, you know, this is no fun anymore. You know, if you look at the balance of, you know, of positive versus negative, it had shifted to the point where the downside just wasn't worth the upside anymore. And that's when I quit altogether. I don't think that's the right path for everyone, but it was definitely the right path for me.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, Claire. And I think bringing it back to that self-awareness piece, you know, I think it's for anybody to decide themselves what they need to do. I guess when we're leading such busy lives and we're predominantly talking to leaders and people in quite high stress jobs, I think it's to just really get people to think and understand about what their relationship is with alcohol as an actual relationship rather than something that they're not, that there's something they're just doing. And I think you mentioned something before around a 30 days of giving up, and it is actually really, that's all the difficult stuff, and none of the magic happens in that 30 days because your body's still getting used to not being on that substance. And I guess from my inquisitivity around this has been, you know, 2020 was a very difficult year for a lot of people. Anxiety levels were kind of high, and it kind of started to, something happened in my awareness around, we're all told that alcohol fuels anxiety, not relieves anxiety. But you don't really know, like, it's all right being told it, but do you actually feel it? Because last year was so heightened, that kind of sparked my curiosity around it. And I thought, I'm just going to see what actually happens if I give up. I said 2 months initially. And so I got over that 30 days. And then in that 60 days, you start to see some of that pink cloud and that magic. And to be honest, I was just curious. I was like, what is my brain like as an adult without alcohol at all? Because I don't think I'd had 30 days off the booze since I was about 16. And I think anybody that's in a role that's creative or they've got some level of responsibility or decision making, the things that I saw that really changed in that kind of probably about 40 to 70 day mark were, I could make decisions better. I didn't question myself as much. I didn't doubt myself. My anxiety calmed down massively. I was getting up earlier, like you said. And I just was like, is this what young people that come to work, don't drink, operate like? Like, and I kind of think I realized that, because I'd had rules, like I've never really drank in the weeks. So it's like, only drink on a weekend. But then if you're drinking on a Sunday, on a Monday, I'm foggy. So you only kind of really get in 3 days a week at work while you're on it, because Thursday you might have had a drink, the weekend starts on a Thursday and you're still drinking on a Sunday. But really, I guess for me, it was a self-awareness of what is my mind like as an adult without any kind of drug, and really trying to think about, well, what are younger people like that are working and are at my toes? How are they operating? It's such an interesting notion.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, the way I've often described it to people is, I think if you're drinking to numb all your emotions, you're drinking to numb the negative stuff, but you actually start numbing all the positive stuff too. So it's a bit like, you know, turning the contrast down on your telly, you know, everything gets sort of muted. And when you've quit for a while, it's like turning the brightness up, you know, everything becomes so much more vivid, as is the best way for me to describe it. But, you know, it does, as you say, it takes a while to get to that point. And, you know, what I would say to anyone listening to this who is interested in examining their relationship with alcohol, if you can, try and give it 100 days without drinking anything at all and just see what a difference it makes, and then make the decision of what you want your relationship with alcohol to be like in the future, once you're more mindful of, you know, what you without any alcohol is like. You know, I think that's a really interesting, you know, experiment to do effectively. You know, and then you can make a decision based on all the, you know, all the available knowledge.
Yeah, I can definitely vouch for that. That's what I've just done, and I just don't think I can go back to drinking as often as I don't want to cut it out altogether, because I do like it, but that it has to change, like the relationship. And if it can't change, it has to go, because of just how much more creative I feel, how much easier life seems. It's like, why would you give up all of that good stuff for a drink? But I don't think we think about it like that. I think, John, you mentioned like a lot of people wear it as a badge of honor. I think particularly in the workplace, I think there's certain industries and sectors that are quite booze heavy, like yeah. Banking, insurance, advertising. I work in advertising, like you, Claire, and drinking is part of how you do business. But there's also a badge of honour around the drinking bit, but also almost surviving on not much sleep. And I think the two really go hand in hand, but I don't think it's any coincidence that there are also industries where people are prone to heart attacks quite early, a lot of stress, a lot of anxiety, a lot of people, when they do go on sick, it's long-term sick. Mm. And this combination of lack of sleep, booze, stress and pressure. And how much better could we be if we just moderated that a bit more?
Yeah, and I think it's really about mindfulness. It's about, you know, I used to drink without thinking about why I was doing it. You know, I just drank mindlessly. And I think if every time you have a drink, you're just conscious of why you're doing it. And, you know, if you're doing it because you're going to a party or you're at a party, that's one thing. But if you're drinking because you're stressed, then, you know, there are much healthier ways and much more effective ways of dealing with stress than drinking. Actually, drinking will just make it worse. And there is a very, you know, very well examined negative feedback loop, you know, in that you drink, it makes you anxious, and the anxiety makes you drink more, and the drinking more makes you more anxious, and so on and so forth. So, you know, so if that's why you're drinking, then, you know, I would suggest finding other ways of dealing with that anxiety and that stress.
Rachel, would you describe yourself then as as Claire described herself, as like an all or nothing person in life anyway? And will you find that, if that is the case, how will you be able to moderate? Because Claire, you say you found that almost impossible to moderate.
Yeah.
John, this is going to turn into a coaching session for me on the podcast if we go on that question. Honestly, I am very curious myself as to answer that question, and I don't know at the minute. I would love, there's a bit of me that doesn't want to give up the booze, and so I'm hoping I can moderate. I'm also waking up to the possibility that it might have to go. I've done full disclosure. I did 93 days. I did 3 full months. And then on Easter Sunday, I got smashed. And it took me 7 days to get over that hangover. I can't even tell you, after not drinking for that long, the impact of drinking 2 bottles of wine had on me. So I haven't drunk since, and I don't particularly intend to for a while, because I'm I'm doing work, I've realized all the benefits. I'm starting my own agency and business as well. And for me, how on it I am without alcohol, and having a little boy who's only 2, and when he looks at me, you know, I hate to say it, but sometimes when I'm hungover and he comes up to me, I'm just like, go away. And what an awful thing to say to a 2-year-old.
But I was like that too, to run away when I was doing bedtime stories so that I could get down to the fridge and get a bottle of wine out, you know, so yeah. I would read really fast.
Or you just skip two pages because there's a glass of wine. So you're reading a story, but you're skipping the whole, the fox doesn't exist in the Gruffalo. And just animals in that story.
Too many animals.
Yeah, or, you know, when he comes in the morning and says, Mommy, and I'm like, go and watch Paw Patrol. And do you know what? If I'm honest, I don't like myself when I do that. And I know it's wrong. I think it's really, I think I'm on a journey of understanding what do I look like without it. I would like to moderate it to your point of, you know, to your question, John. I would like to, and I would like to disprove some. I got to like your bit on day 163 in the book, Claire, and I did feel a bit disappointed in myself. But then I thought, no, you know, my I talked about this on other podcasts. My brother has a heroin addiction, so I live with that. So I'm very aware of it's not to that degree. But yeah, I'm just very curious, I think. Yeah. And what's interesting is because I've been curious about this, a lot of my friends have started to be curious. So I think in your early 30s, nobody wants you to give up because it's everybody's point of view. What I've been really surprised about, and I think what's a real positive post-COVID, is when I did Dry January in 2020, and honestly, people, like, I was treated like a leper, Yeah, like, honestly, I was outcast. Like, people said, we're not going to invite you to stuff until you start drinking again. and then going through COVID, and then me saying I was going to do, I said I was going to do 100 days, or I said 3 months, and four of my friends joined me on it. They lasted for 40 days. So thank you, Claire. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Sazzy. Sazzy went 60 days. And they all felt massively different. And what's been really... we were all big drinkers, and actually all of them have changed their approach to it and drinking less as a result. So I think a lot of people are waking up to it, and I think it's just curiosity.
Yeah, I think the trick with a moderation thing is you just have to know yourself really well. So, you know, so if you do 100 days without anything at all, and then you know, having analysed your relationship and how you want to drink and how much you want to drink, set yourself some really strict rules. You know, these are the sorts of occasions at which I will drink, you know, birthday parties, blah, 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 blah. This is the maximum amount I want to drink a week, and so on. So set yourself some really strict rules. And if you can stick to those, then, you know, all well and good. And if you can stick to them without them driving you crazy, all well and good. I think the difficulty comes if you set those rules and you find it impossible to stick with them, and actually trying to stick with them makes you utterly miserable. And then you might come to the realization, as I did, that actually you're happier just taking it out of the equation altogether. But, you know, that's a personal decision based on you and, you know, the way your dopamine receptors work. And that's something you sort of have to work out yourself.
Yeah, I really like that, Claire. And actually, that's what happened to me with being a vegetarian. So I've not eaten any meat at all now for a year and a half. But for the year prior to that, I was kind of not eating meat Monday to Friday. And in the end, I actually just found it far less stressful to just cut it out altogether. Because when I go to a restaurant now, my decision tree is so much smaller. Dallied around with that, and then I was like, actually now life is, people say to me, oh, how do you cope now? And I'm like, life is so much easier because it's a whole food group just doesn't exist to me.
Well, you know, I find it the same with diets. You know, once you know how you work, so I know I'm all or nothing, and as a result I find diets really hard, and I put on, like a load of people, I put on a whole stone over COVID, you know, because I was comfort eating, I wasn't doing as much exercise, you know, I was cooking all the time for the kids, you know, so I put on a stone. And, you know, I find moderating food just as hard as I find moderating anything. So the best diet for me is intermittent fasting diet, you know, where you eat between certain hours and you don't eat between, you know, for other hours. So I do 16-8. And, you know, and that for me works really well because it's all or nothing. And, you know, it's just about knowing yourself, and then you can find the best ways of doing all sorts of things.
Yeah. Let's go back to the culture of drinking and in the workplace. You know, last year, a lot of people, especially people that listen to this podcast, so in professional services, will have worked from home last year. So that kind of socialization aspect of work and the bar in the office or the pub drink, you know, the drink in the pub on a Friday afternoon won't have happened for a lot of people in the workplace for a year. We're now going to move back into either hybrid working, or people start to come back to a physical office. And I'm just wondering what leaders might be could think about for having a more inclusive approach to their team, to perhaps a bit more awareness of health, given we've just been through a global pandemic and where people sit with their physical and mental health. Anxiety is likely to be rife for a while. What are your thoughts regarding that, Claire? And what could a leader be thinking about if they were thinking, I don't know what to do with this, but what I do know is we perhaps can't go back to how we were?
Yeah, it's tricky. I think as a leader, you set, you know, you lead by example. And, you know, if your team see you, you know, using alcohol in a particular way, encouraging drinking in certain circumstances, then that will become the team culture. And, you know, and if you, you know, if you don't want that to be the team culture, then effectively, you know, you're the one that really needs to start changing it. You know, I mean, I was terrible. You know, I used to encourage my team constantly to go out for a boozy lunch on a Friday, to sort of do loads of work around the, you know, in the office bar, you know, and I imagine there were people who didn't want to be on my team because they didn't like the way that was part of the culture. But, you know, that didn't bother me, actually, because I didn't want anyone teetotal on the team either. So, you know, I think it really is, you know, like everything as a leader, it's down to you to set an example. And just a story that I still haunts me now is I remember taking my team out for a boozy lunch one Friday, and I came back to the office to discover an email from a really important client, basically telling me that they wanted to make all sorts of changes to a TV ad that we just shot, which I didn't agree with at all. And because I'd been drinking with my team and because I was feeling really reckless, you know, I fired off a really what I thought was quite brilliant, but was actually rather inappropriate email to my client, which my team all thought was fabulous. And I got fired off the business. And if I'd been sober, I never would have sent that email. I would have realized, I would have looked ahead. I would have realized it was the wrong thing to do. I mean, I was setting a really bad example, not just by taking everyone out for a boozy lunch, but by then coming back and sending an email, which was, you know, quite patently inappropriate. So, you know, it does make you act in ways that you probably wouldn't and shouldn't if in the normal way of things.
So Claire, you've just come back from the wine bar, you've had a few glasses of wine, maybe a little bit more, and you've fired this email off. Do you think that extends to people having had a really rough night the night before and then coming into the office and doing similar things, this recklessness that they actually don't see and don't associate with the fact that they were having a drink the day before?
Yes, I do, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, it's a slightly different mood. I mean, if you've just been drinking, you're more likely to be reckless. If you're hungover, you're likely to be less empathetic, you're likely to be more grouchy and grumpy. You're in that sort of mood, you're more likely to accidentally offend somebody or say something hurtful or you know, so it has different, you know, that drinking culture has different impacts at different stages, but certainly it's, you know, can lead to, you know, it can lead to working in a really sort of suboptimal way. And, you know, as Rachel was saying earlier, you know, when you've got young people coming into the business who don't drink at all, you know, they've got all this energy and this positivity and this creativity. And if you're the old soak in the office who is coming in with a hangover and not really firing on all cylinders till lunchtime, you know, you've got to watch out.
Yeah, I think what you've just explained there, and the two of you are bringing this up really nicely, is Barbara Fredrickson's broaden and build theory, where Barbara Fredrickson looks at your thought action repertoire. So this is when you have more access to all of your thought armory, if you like. So your creativity, your empathy, humility, your skills or your capability or your past history. And when it's broad, it's broad, and this is why the theory is called broaden and build. You broaden, then you build your skills and you become better at your job, you become better at leading, you become better at working with other people. I think what we don't make the connection to is that when we're either drunk, so when you've had a few wines after at lunch, you're perhaps more reckless. And when you're more reckless, when you're hungover, you're more subdued, hungover, stressed, and you're always on the back foot. I think when you're hungover, your day never starts quite as smoothly. That's when your thought action repertoire narrows. So you put your body in a heightened stress and you get the tunnel vision. So you think when you're when you've had a few drinks, I mean, you're in like a childlike state anyway, because you don't have access to the future you. But it also narrows your thought action repertoire. So you get tunnel vision and you only see like what you saw, Claire, the ad you wanted, and therefore woe betide any thought to the future or that relationship. But also when you're hungover the next day and you're perhaps going into a difficult conversation with somebody, or you're needing to have stakeholder management conversations, when your thought action repertoire is narrowed, you're only seeing your survival. You're acting in a fight or flight kind of response. And often, I mean, fight or flight for me sums up being hungover all the time. It's just like pure survival, get through the day. And I think when we're operating in that narrower state of being, we don't have access to our full creativity, our full opportunities, problem solve, our full perspective taking capability. And it's really thinking about how many more days can we have where we're operating at our best so we can broaden and build, rather than even just two glasses of wine on a night will put us into a fight or flight way of being, be it for having a difficult conversation, a client relationship, or problem solving on a piece of work. And making that connection to think about that the best kind of leaders that we are seeing emerge now are ones that don't drink, or that definitely don't drink as in a social context of work. And I think that's a trend we are going to see, because the demands of people now to be more flexible, more agile, more adaptive, there's too much going on now. There's too much to deal with, that the way of leading 20 years ago, where you could drink because decisions couldn't be made so quickly because the technology wasn't there to enable the work to be done at speed.
Yeah. You know, I've always been quite fascinated by Anna Wintour, who, you know, is in obviously in the fashion business, which is, you know, a relatively boozy business, as is the magazine business. And she doesn't drink. She's never drunk. And what she says is, she says that part of her success is down to the fact that she doesn't drink, because she would go to four parties in one night. She would go in, do the networking, talk to the people she needed to talk to, leave, do the next one. And she'd do four in a night and she would remember everything and, you know, would be completely on form and would never say the wrong thing, you know, whereas everyone else was going to the one party, getting plastered, you know, saying the wrong thing and then not being able to remember anything the next day anyway. So, and I'm exaggerating for effect, but, you know, it does, you know, as you say, a lot of the, if you look at the sort of a lot of the top leaders in politics or in, you know, in most industries, you will find that there are a large number of them who really don't drink, because they realize that they're, you know, they are able to achieve a lot more without. And, you know, just from a personal perspective, you know, I'd always wanted to write books. You know, when I was little, being an author was my, you know, my big dream. And I didn't, you know, it went by the wayside, my writing, you know, just I was working too hard and playing too hard. And as soon as I quit drinking, I had this real urge to write. And I started writing every day, first a blog, which I called Mummy Was a Secret Drinker. And then that turned into a memoir. And now I write fiction. And, you know, in the 6 years since I quit, I've had two books published and I've written a third, which is coming out next year. And I never, ever could have got all of that done when I was drinking. There's no way, you know, I mean, part of the reason I've been able to do it is because I get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and I write for 3 hours before my kids wake up. And I love it. You know, that's not a hardship. It's fantastic.
That's wonderful, Claire. And I'm really curious to know, how painful is it now to talk about alcohol? So the analogy I really want to sort of use is, when I stopped smoking, all I could think about was smoking. It was like every waking hour. And then eventually it sort of dissipates and dissipates. And I've not smoked now for over 15 years. But at the time, I found it really, really, really invasive. It was all I could ever think about. How do you think about it now? I mean, obviously, we're talking about it today, but on a day-to-day basis, has that now gone? Your writings first and foremost in the front of your mind, yeah. And away you go.
It is exactly the same as quitting smoking. You know, I was a big smoker too, and I quit 20 years ago. Like you know, the first year or even 2 years, you know, I mean, if somebody was smoking around me, I was utterly aware of it, and I would sort of inhale the smoke and dream about it, you know. And you know, for a long time it becomes quite obsessive. And very gradually, you know, it tails off to the point where, you know, you just don't think about it at all. It's just not part of your, it's not on your radar. It's not part of your thought process. So, you know, now I'll go to a party and I won't notice other people drinking. I won't, unless they get completely plastered, which is, I might, but I don't notice who's drinking, what they're drinking. It doesn't even cross my mind that I might have a drink myself. You know, it very much in the same way that I wouldn't ever have a cigarette. So, you know, and all I can say is that happens really gradually. But when you get to the point where you realize that you haven't thought about it at all for a whole day, you know, it's miraculous, because you realize how much more space you have in your head to think about other things. And, you know, people do extraordinary things when they quit drinking, because not only do you have more physical time, because you're not hungover, you're not drunk, so you've got more hours of the day when you're physically on form, but you have loads more mental space too. You've got loads more room in your head to do other things with. And for me, it was writing. For other people, you know, it might be sport of some sort, or art, or, you know, jewelry making. People go on and do extraordinary things when they quit drinking, because, you know, because of that, because of all that time and, you know, energy that you free up.
Yeah, I think on that, Claire, I think a lot of people would say, even if you don't quit altogether, but you cut down massively, like I listen to a lot of the One Year No Beer podcasts, and they have people that say that at work they get so much more productive, they sleep so much better. So there's so many things if you just change your relationship with alcohol and are a bit more mindful of it. If I may, we've got you on the podcast, and you did mention you've got three children. And so I would just like to talk about something around women and maternity and that transition in the life and the role of alcohol in it. It's something that I've observed amongst my friends and colleagues in the workplace, that women are having children slightly later now in the professional world. So you've kind of got to a stage where you're quite established and good at your career. And then in your 30s, you go and have a baby at a time when you are equal to your male counterparts, and then you come back and you're probably not. And then you've got to kind of juggle kids at home, still having to work, maybe only doing 4 days at work. And I think, you know, we are seeing an instance of this mummy's juice, and mummy deserves this wine, and play dates with wine, and alcohol becoming this thing for it. I think before it was always kind of seen as quite a masculine thing to have a problem, and for men to be drinking too much. I'm just wondering, with more women trying to work, have a nice home life, still be a very present mum, that wine's becoming this kind of way to relax for a lot of women, because they're going through a massive period of transition in their life, trying to juggle things. What are your thoughts on that transition?
The mummy wine culture is really pervasive and really dangerous, actually, you know, and I totally bought into it, you know. So my social media feed was filled with all those memes about mummy's little helper and wine o'clock, and, you know, all the jokes about how much wine you needed to cope with having the kids at home in the holidays or whatever it might be, you know. And And I think, you know, we were told that we, our generation, that we could have it all. And the truth is, you know, you can have it all, but trying to have it all at the same time is really, really hard. And, you know, something's got to give. And in my case, it was my health, because, you know, I was using wine as a way of coping with that massive juggling act. And I didn't think, because everybody, it felt like everyone else around me was doing the same. As you say, you know, there's, you know, play dates, you were more likely to be offered a glass of wine than a cup of tea. And at the school gates, everyone was, you know, on a Friday, it would all be, so I can't wait to get home and open the wine, you know, or is it wine o'clock yet? You know, all those sorts of jokes. So, you know, you're made to feel like it's perfectly normal. And what we forget is that, you know, our women's bodies don't metabolize wine or alcohol generally as well as men's do. So, you know, you can't keep drinking, you know, at that level and not have it have some impact or other. So yes, I do think, and it was for me, you know, what I felt like having a glass of wine at the end of the day when I was, you know, I had three kids in bed, was me time. It was my adult time. It was my way of segueing from, you know, daytime to evening. And, you know, and I think a lot of women drink like that. And we also, you know, in our mother's generation, they never drank at home alone. You know, that was seen as being, you know, really out of order. And yet, you know, all around the country, you'll find women putting their children to bed and sitting down and having a large glass of wine on their own. And that's not seen as, they don't think that that's a problem, but it is.
I think there's a big job for perhaps leaders in businesses that predominantly have a boozy culture to support women that have children a bit more like that, be it with coaching or at that level, but also an awareness for women. Because I think it was in your book that I read it in, or perhaps it was The Secret Joy of Being Sober, around actually as you get older as a woman as well, your body stops producing the enzymes that breaks down the alcohol in your body. And this doesn't happen to men the same way. So as a woman, when you hit your 40s and 50s, the hangovers will feel worse because they are worse, because your body's not breaking down the alcohol, particularly as you approach the menopause.
Yeah, alcohol and menopause don't mix at all. It's like sort of, you know, it's like pouring rocket fuel on a fire.
I can imagine with the hot flushes and everything. Yeah, no, thank you for that. I think that's quite useful for our female listeners.
What you were talking about there then sounded to me a little bit like it's an element of reward, really, for the day and the difficulty of the day. That you'd sit down and have a glass of wine after you put the kids to bed. I'm thinking of it from a guy's point of view, and they would go to the pub. You'd had a hard day at work. You go to the pub. And I wonder how much of the reason that they want to go to the pub, and if you were finding it difficult not to go, would be about fear of missing out and being out of the group. So all of a sudden, John's not coming to the pub like he used to do on a Friday. He's going home. And so there's the element of fear of missing out because you're not going, and there's the element of being out of group. What's your thoughts on that, Claire?
You know, I think that is actually one of the hardest things about quitting is other people's reactions, you know, and your fear that no one is going to want invite you to a party ever again. And even if they do invite you to a party, they're going to see you as being really boring. And, you know, I mean, I was really worried about all of that sort of stuff. And the truth is, a small number of my friends I did drift away from slightly, you know, the ones actually that had a real alcohol issue themselves, because they were the ones that found it hardest when I stopped. But, you know, I more than made up for it with the number of people that I became friendly with who, you know, I never would have considered being friends with in the past because they didn't drink as much as I did. So, you know, but actually, for me, what is really important is that you don't decide that, you know, because you don't want to drink, you can't go. You know, it's because, you know, being, we are social people, being sociable is, you know, is a, still a great way of winding down even without the alcohol. And, you know, you don't want to miss out. None of us want to miss out. And what I suggest, and it, you know, especially once you're a bit more used to not drinking, you just have a repertoire of alcohol-free drinks that you can drink instead. So I'm a huge fan of alcohol-free beer, which tastes just like the real thing, looks just like the real thing, but it's got hardly any calories and it's really good for you, and it's, you know, doesn't get you drunk. And, you know, if you're going to the pub with a whole group of people and one of them is drinking alcohol-free beer, no one's going to notice or care, or, you know, I mean, it's just, you're still joining in, you're still being you, you're still just as much fun, possibly more fun than you were before. You know, also see lip and tonic, just like, you know, a gin and tonic, but, you know, without all the downsides. So yeah, having a good repertoire of you know, alcohol-free drinks that you can order instead means you can just carry on as you did before, but just on better form.
Yeah, and that's good advice. And I wonder sometimes when people start behaving a little bit differently around their friends as to whether their friends, because you mentioned this a little bit earlier on, really, Rachel, with your friends, whether actually they almost need somebody out of the group to make the first move. And maybe over a period of time, they start thinking about it themselves and think, well, actually, if they can do it, perhaps I can do it. And it's almost about creating that awareness around it, that what is it that's made that person cut down or moderate or even stop completely.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? I mean, you find I can tell what somebody's relationship is with alcohol by the conversation they have with me about me not drinking. So somebody who is not bothered about it at all doesn't even notice. So they won't notice I'm not drinking. They won't bring it up. It's just not on their radar. And I'm that person now myself. And then you've got the person who, you know, is what we sort of describe as sober curious, who is sort of thinking about it and thinking, well, maybe I should do something about my relationship with alcohol, and they will want to know everything, you know. And then you've got the person who knows they've got a problem and doesn't want to face it, and they won't talk to you at all. And those are the three camps.
Then we must fall into the middle camp then, Rachel.
Definitely sober curious. I have got a question for you, though. With everything you know now, if you could go back to your leadership days in the advertising industry, what would you do different as a leader, knowing what you know now?
Oh, well, I think I would have been, I mean, I thought I was pretty good at my job, you know, but I think I would have been a hell of a lot better if I hadn't been drinking, or at least if I hadn't been drinking so much. And, you know, I think what I could have encouraged, done myself and encouraged other people to do, was find other ways to socialize and other ways to de-stress that didn't involve just going to the pub. So, you know, I would have done more team expeditions to the theater, say, or to a sporting event, or, you know, and we did, you know, as a company, we did do things like, you know, have yoga lessons at lunchtime, but, you know, more of that sort of thing, a running club, a yoga club, you know, sort of different ways of, you know, talks in the evening that didn't revolve around alcohol, but revolved more around sort of well-being and, you know, sort of just, you know, other interesting stuff. So, you know, I mean, I think I should have been a lot more creative about the way that we, as a team, de-stressed, and about the way that we socialized, other than just automatically thinking it had to involve some form of booze.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting one. I think, like, having team teas in the afternoon is quite a nice way, and bake-offs as well, and
yeah,
like, yeah. I am. What's your biggest regret looking back from being a leader? And what's the one thing that you wish you would have changed?
It's tricky because, you know, I'm not sure how many regrets I have in that I loved, you know, my job. I loved most of it. I think the main issue is it got to the point where I just couldn't deal with the stress anymore. And, you know, I wish I had learnt healthy ways of dealing with stress. And I think that would have made me a much better leader. I probably would have carried on working in that industry for a bit longer, which may or may not have been a good thing. And I certainly would have been a lot more effective.
Yeah, I think this is something that we observe in our coaching sessions sometimes. It's the notion of, they call it in psychology, self-handicapping, where you've got this idea of what your full potential could be, but then you're kind of scared of it, of really pushing yourself. So what you do is you find behaviours that self-handicap you slightly. So you've got an excuse as to why you weren't at your best. So examples of self-handicapping can be, you've got a big presentation the next day or the night. So what you might do is procrastinate on that, preparing that big pitch of business. So you have to pull an all-nighter. So then you've got the excuse of, well, you did it at the last minute if you don't win the work, or you were tired and exhausted because you'd done an all-nighter. So you have the excuse of not having enough sleep as to kind of protect you from if you didn't win the work. Or people might have like a big talk to do or a big important thing, but then they'll go out and get drunk the night before because they need to socialize with their team. But then if the presentation goes well, they can say, oh, and I did that hungover. But if it doesn't go so well, because I was a bit flat today because I had that big client boozy lunch. And I think with the stress and what you just talked about then is we have to just be careful and aware of when we're self-handicapping and when we're actually dealing with the underlying issue of what's going on. And people have different kinds of self-handicapping behavior. Booze is just one of them, but procrastination is a big one. It leads to imposter syndrome. Putting yourself down is another big one. Not sleeping enough is a big one. So it's just having an awareness of that. And particularly if you've got any element of stress in your life.
Yeah. Something else that I'm very conscious of now that I'm not sure I realized back then is I have a huge fear of failure. And I think problem is when you're quite successful, you know, at your job and, you know, and always have been, you don't get used to dealing with failure. And as a result, the idea of failing is really frightening. So what you do is you avoid putting yourself in any situation where you might fail. And, you know, and again, I used alcohol as a way of dampening that fear of failure. And actually, you know, avoiding opportunities is the easiest way to fail, you know. So, you know, and when I quit drinking, I became so much more courageous because, you know, suddenly I was having to deal with emotions in the raw that I'd never dealt with before. And, you know, and something we haven't touched on, which we don't really have time to go into, but, you know, I was diagnosed with breast cancer 8 months after I quit drinking. And, you know, I dealt with that without alcohol as a crutch. And coming out of that period, I thought, you know, actually I can do anything now. And all those things I've been really scared of in the past, like trying to write a book and being turned down by agents and publishers, hell, who cares? You know, there are way worse things that can happen. And I've dealt with the worst things that can happen. So, you know, so actually fear of failure, I think, is a thing that held me back the most in life. And, you know, and I don't have that anymore.
Yeah, that is a wonderful place to wrap that one up. But before we do wrap up, we do ask all of our guests to share their three leadership essentials. So what would be your three tips to start somebody on this sober curious journey?
Well, I would suggest initially that you give yourself a break off the booze, whether that's 30 days or, you know, ideally I would give it 100 days and just, you know, take notice of how you feel and what you find difficult, what you find easy, what changes, all that sort of stuff. And then the second thing is once you've got to the end of that period, then I would just say, you know, decide mindfully what you want your relationship to be, because probably your relationship now is one you've fallen into without thinking about it. So, you know, having got a bit of distance from it, you know, decide what you want your relationship to be. Do you want to drink at all? If so, how much and when don't you, and all those sorts of things. Then set yourself rules based on that. And then the third thing is, you know, having got to that point and being, set yourself some rules and being really mindful about why and when you're drinking, you know, just keep an eye on it. Just see, you know, see whether you can stick to those rules. And if you can't, then, you know, you might want to consider quitting altogether. So, you know, that's the journey that I would suggest going through, just as a reset.
They're really useful, Claire. I just want to ask you, how would you go about it if you were a leader and you were thinking about your team? Is it about you setting the example in many respects first? Or, you know, you, let's say you've got a team and the culture has been around, well, yeah, every Friday we go to the pub and, you know, people just generally drink and enjoy themselves but are under par because of it. But you, as a leader, think, right, okay, how do I approach this with my team?
Well, what I wish I'd done and what I would do now in that situation is I would ask the members of my team, and particularly the younger ones, what other things they might want to do as a team that don't involve just going to the pub. Mm-hmm. And you don't need to set it out as a, you know, you're all drinking too much and we've all got to change, you know, just as a, look, you know, this is, we're being a bit unimaginative here. What else can we do? Do we want to have, you know, team running sessions? Do we want to have team yoga sessions? You know, what do, you know, baking, you know, what else can we do as a group that, you know, would be a good way of bonding and de-stressing. And then sort of with that team, creating a sort of, oh, just a more interesting timetable. And drinking can still be part of it, but just not as big a part.
Yeah, so what else can we do rather than just being it, that one thing?
I'll just add to that, because the last place I was working at, an agency called IMA in Leeds, there were a couple of leaders there that had stopped drinking as much. And it was a big transition from a boozy culture, you know, and still a lot of it is boozy, but a transition away from doing other things. And what was nice about what came from that was this idea around doing like weekly sessions, or I think they ended up being monthly sessions, where people could just drop in and talk about the mental health and talk about what was going on in them. And I think this seems so foreign from like 10 years ago, but actually you are your holistic self in work. And if people can talk about what they're doing and how they're trying to give up it, they often feel more supported and it's all voluntary. You can opt in or out, but just having that, a space where people can have that conversation and groups where you are going to talk about making lifestyle change. And I think what's really interesting and a big observation I made is younger people, you know, you're under 30, are very, very, they see alcohol as part of their diet, i.e. calorie content and how healthy it is. So there's a really nice link into, you can learn a lot off some younger members of your team, because they'd rather drink a Costa coffee that I look at and think that's full of sugar and calories, but they look at a wine and think, my goodness, what are you doing? So just having those perhaps some health clubs or a mental wellness session, you could also have these discussions there too in the work.
Yeah, and you know, we talked about FOMO earlier, and I think the, you know, part of the problem is that, you know, if you quit drinking, you think that you're going to be missing out on, you know, a lot of work bonding opportunities, a lot of networking opportunities. And, you know, and that needn't be the case. We just need to rethink what those networking and bonding opportunities are, and just, you know, and it makes for a much richer, you know, experience, having more than doing more as a group than just going to the pub, you know. So
I think that's been a really, really positive thing that's come out of COVID, actually, that the amount of networking groups that I go to now that are on Zoom rather than the pub. And actually, it's just as nice to network and get to know people on Zoom, but without the alcohol. And now I think, before I'd have thought I could never go to a networking event, and sometimes I just have a tonic, or an alcohol-free beer, but you'd always, there'd always be that temptation to perhaps have one. And now I think, oh, actually, I'd just go and not drink and not worry about what was in my hand. And I'd feel totally fine because I've done it virtually.
Yes. And if you think about it, those, you know, all those pub sessions, they all blur into one, you know, they're all the same, you know. And I look back at my years in the office, and some of my, you know, the events, the work-based events I remember most vividly are things like, you know, the weekend when we went and did an army training course, you know, and that didn't involve, it involved a little bit of alcohol at, you know, the end of the session, but, you know, it was hardly, it was all, you know, physical activity and sort of, you know, all sorts of stuff. You know, it's those sorts of things that you really remember. It's not just another night in the pubs.
So just before we wrap up, Claire, I'll just mention one thing on your first leadership essential where you said, you know, decide that you're going to take a break. And what I'll just do a plug for your book here. One of the big pieces of advice I would say on that is do keep a diary if you can, to like what you said on your second one around recording how you're feeling and how effective you are, because it is important that you can notice when you're up and when you're down. But I also would massively advocate reading your book, because what I really like about it is you talk about it day by day, what you're going through. And it can be quite lonely. I think it's particularly the first time I did 30 days off the booze. You're often the only one feeling it. So I'd just grab your book and go, well, what was Claire going through at that point? And if it wasn't that day, I mean, there's, I didn't get the pink cloud till a fair bit later than you. But actually, I could always then skip ahead or behind and find something that I could resonate to. And there's not many books that, you know, there's other books that I've read around alcohol, and I've definitely thought, oh, I'm not in that absolute uber alcoholic category. So it's too far extreme from me. Whereas I think the way that you fell into it, just as particularly through that leadership lens, just really talks to just being more aware, you know, grab yourself a diary and diarize it yourself, what you're going through, but also asking your team and the people that are closest to you how they find you different. And I think as a leader, it would be an interesting observation on the 60 day mark, asking your team how approachable you've been, how much do they feel like you've had more or less time for them? Do they feel better understood? Does the work quality seem better? And I think just been very open to that and seeing what you observe.
That's a great idea. Yeah.
Thank you so much for your time, Claire. It's just been such a privilege to have this conversation with you. You've been an inspiration to me, so I just want to say a personal thank you. I've really loved reading your book.
Thank you. Well, thank you for having me, guys. I've really enjoyed the conversation. It's been great fun. Thank you.
It's been great to have you on your show, Claire. Thank you very much.
Oh, Claire, just one note. If people would like to find a little bit more about you, where can they find out about you? What's your other book called?
So my books are called The Sober Diaries, and the novel is called The Authenticity Project, both of them on Amazon and in the bookshops. I have on YouTube and TED.com, you can find my TED talk, which is called Making Sober Less Shameful, which is all about the shame wrapped up with addiction. And you can find me on social media. So on Facebook, I'm Sober Mummy. On Instagram and Twitter, I'm Claire Pooley.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. We'll put them in the show notes.
Thank you for listening to the Building Better Leaders podcast. We hope you found today's leadership essentials and coaching discussion points useful. If you'd like to read more about the approach we take, check out our website at scaffoldcoaching.com. You've been listening to the Building Better Leaders podcast, brought to you by Scaffold Coaching.
My husband said to me, we met on Tinder, and he said, oh, you know, I knew you were the one when you ordered a rare steak and we shared a bottle of Malbec. And he's like, now I'm married to a vegan teetotaler. Like, horrendous.
There's a chapter in my book called "Not the Woman He Married," because I was really worried about that with my husband. You know, that he'd think, "Oh God, I didn't buy into this." You know, but actually, he was very good about it.
Literally, that is it. And Gareth's like biggest fear now is he's just like, "Oh goodness." However, you know, the first 30 days are difficult, and you are a bit ratty. But there were bits after that that he's like, this is just brilliant. And, you know, obviously seeing me having my little day off on Easter Sunday was like, no, babe, you keep going. You are better without this, you know.
Yeah, and my husband says the same.
Yeah, and
he misses the fact, you know, being able to go out for on a boozy night from time to time, but he doesn't miss everything else that comes with that, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah.